Welcome to the Partial Historians.
We explore all the details of ancient Rome.
Everything from political scandals, the love affairs, the battles waged, and when citizens turn against each other. I'm Dr. Rad.
And I'm Dr. G. We consider Rome as the Romans saw it by reading different authors from the ancient past and comparing their stories.
Join us as we trace the journey of Rome from the founding of the city. Hello and welcome to a brand new episode of The Partial Historians. I am one of your hosts, Dr. Rad.
And I am Dr. G.
So exciting, Dr. G, because we are in yet another new recording setup.
Oh, yeah, this is very exciting. Dear listeners, through the valued support of our honored patrons, we've been able to purchase some slightly upgraded microphones. Hello.
I know, and a mixer and everything.
I'm feeling like a genuine sound engineer who does not know what they're doing.
I know. Look, it probably sounds crazy to you that we didn't have these things before, but hey, you know, podcasting on a shoestring. And to be honest, it's also been very much affected by the fact that I have moved so many times that we needed to keep changing our microphones based on where I was living, apparently.
Yeah, changing our setup every year or so, trying to figure out what would work in what space.
And, yes, exactly.
Yeah, but we're pretty excited for this.
We are hoping that this is the sound.
Dun, dun.
Insert one of our high quality free sound effects here.
Oh, I'm going to keep the vocals. Come on.
Yeah. But that is not the only thing that is new in our life at the moment, Dr. G. Apart from these microphones.
I'm so excited. We are absolutely thrilled to announce our upcoming new book. I know. We never thought we'd write another book again.
We really didn't. Particularly not so soon.
But we were absolutely floored to be approached by Ulysses Press.
Yes.
And they are really interested in ancient Rome, but like with a bit of fun involved and a little bit of like, you know, greatest hits elements.
Absolutely.
And we were like very happy to provide that. We're like, there are so many greatest hits when it comes to ancient Rome.
Yes. So we are currently in the editing phase with this particular book. It will be out in November of this year, but you can pre-order it now. It will be a little bit different to Rex in that we are going to be taking a slightly more populist tone, I'm going to say, in a very wanky way.
What that means, what that translates to, is less footnotes.
Yes.
Maybe no footnotes.
More jokes, more Drag Race references that I'm sneaking in, even though Dr. G begs me not to.
I can assure you that there are some Monty Python puns.
Excellent.
And references. So
yes.
I'm excited for that.
Yeah. So basically it's us doing what we've always done, which is taking academic material. Thank you, academics. And translating it into something really fun and a little bit lighter to read so that if you're going on a holiday and you want some Roman history, you don't have to take every volume of Edward Gibbon with you.
Phew. Well, that's going to free up some space in the old luggage.
So, Dr. G, can you tell us, just to give them a bit of a taste, what are some of our sections in the book?
Oh, goodness. All right. Now, So thinking about some of the sections of the book, we went for puns all the way down in chapter titles.
I can't help myself when it comes to titles. It's my one true gift in life.
The one that I'm working on at the moment is Better Call Sulla.
Ooh.
Which I quite like.
I do like that one. And that was actually all you.
Why, thank you. But you caught some great ones. Dead time stories.
That is one of the sections where you will find stories of notable deaths in ancient Rome. Mm. I did also like your animal tales. Wink, wink.
And we built this city on rock and roads.
Mm, they certainly did. To be honest, that's not a pun. That's just the truth.
It's just the literal truth. Exactly. It's not my fault somebody wrote a song about it.
Yeah. So if that sounds like your cup of tea, please jump on and pre-order now, because I suspect that the more pre-orders there are, the more our publishers will think, yes, we need more of this kind of stuff. We want to commission more books.
And I think this is the thing with modern publishing as well. Like, pre-orders do count for a lot of the sort of hyping up of something as well. So if you're interested and you enjoy our podcast, and especially if you enjoyed Rex, I think, because this will give you a sense of comparison between the different styles that these kinds of writing of history could take.
Absolutely.
Because our personalities, I think, are going to come through and shine through really strongly.
Oh, they will.
In both books.
Yeah.
But like the way that they're laid out and the way that they do the history is going to probably look like a little bit different. So yes. I think that's really interesting as well. What I would say.
I agree. And because this is written in a series of short stories, I suppose. That's really what it is, kind of like short stories and trivia and that kind of thing from ancient Rome. There's just huge diversity. They're not too long. And it really is one of those things where you can just dive in and dive out. You know, you don't have to sit there and read the whole book in one sitting in order to understand it. I know. Although you will, of course, miss the cumulative effect of my Drag Race sneaky references.
And we wouldn't recommend missing that.
Exactly. But yeah, it is one of those things where you could definitely, you know, take a chapter for a class. Not one of the rude ones.
I guess it depends on the school's policy.
Well, yes. I mean, we do have a chapter on phalluses.
Well. You've let the cat out of the bag.
I know. But you know what? I figured it was going to happen anyway with a phallic Thursday. So why not do it now? Because today will be a Thursday by the time we release this episode. That is our day of choice.
That is. That's true.
Yeah.
All right.
So
without further ado.
Let's do it. Okay. So Dr. G, we normally don't spruik our book. We normally talk about ancient Roman history. We go at a snail's pace.
We are trying to win the award for the longest ever undertaking of Roman history on podcast.
I think we can do it. I mean, you know, I know that
we ain't got no rivals right now. Everybody else has already finished.
Exactly. And when you go to your lib section in your library and you see all the volumes of Livy, you think, wow, that's long. you wait.
And you're up to book 5.
Yeah. Not finished yet, just up to it. Yeah.
Yeah.
All right, so we're talking about early Republican history.
We are.
Last time, we actually covered a couple of years because there wasn't a huge amount going on, but certainly Rome was at war.
Mm, they were. And, you know, I've had a dearth of sources for quite some time now. And I've really just got like place names, hints and tips about where Rome might have been having some like military dissatisfaction or satisfaction, depending on the day.
Military dissatisfaction. I like that way of saying war. Yes. Well, last time we were setting up the siege at Veii, which we know is going to be something that's ongoing and long. But we also were dealing with warfare against the Volscians. Good old Volscians.
Yeah, one of those classic ongoing nemesises of Rome.
Yes, exactly. And they actually had a bit of a victory against the Volscians thanks to a treacherous slave. Can't get good help these days.
Servius Romanus, I believe his name was.
That's correct. Yeah. Well, that's the name he was given, of course, after he turned code.
And what do you think he was called before he got that name?
Oh, I hate to think. Loyalist Mostest.
Shining star of the Volsci.
That's right. He was the best live they ever had. But anyway, so they had some victories, which was good because, you know, the situation at Veii is just kind of at a bit of a standstill, if I'm honest. But we did also, even a little bit before that, something which I think is going to be significant to recap. We've been dealing with the issue of military pay, Dr. G.
Yes.
Mm.
Yeah, look, Livy seems to suggest that, 406 is the first year where military pay gets introduced.
I believe so.
Pretty sure that's just a sort of a hint of maybe the professionalization of the army that will come much later.
Yes.
This seems to be a bit of a one-off, maybe based on circumstance.
Yes, and I think that's very much tied up with the situation at Vey. And since that's our focus today, I thought I'd better mention that because we went through the whole backstory. If you want to hear more about it, please go and check out our episode on 406 BCE to hear all the details. But certainly there's a lot of debate about actually what was going on, why it was introduced. Was it introduced? What form did it take? There are just so many questions that are unanswered.
Where does the money come from?
Exactly. Follow the money. So I definitely suggest checking out that episode if you want the full backstory. But with that being said, Dr. G, I think it's time to dive into 403 BCE. See us right now, listeners, but we always do wavy arms when that happens.
we insert music later in post.
We do, and we have to remind ourselves by doing the wavy arms. All right, Dr. G, now I'm guessing that Dionysius is still keeping his distance from you.
How dare he? I'm so sad.
He's the first man that I've known who's able to keep away from you.
I do have some very exciting news, though.
What is that?
I do have a new source.
Is it Valerius Maximus?
Yes, and?
I feel like I'm in improvisation here. What's your other source?
The other source is Plutarch. I
of
know.
Of course, Plutarch. Damn it, I knew that.
I was like, Valerius Maximus, how did she know?
That is exciting stuff. That is exciting stuff. But look, even though you have Plutarch and Valerius Maximus and therefore actually outsource me, I'm still going to let you do the magistrates because I feel like it's kind of become your thing.
And also, like, as fair warning, neither of the sources that I have are annalistic in nature. So
well, I had a feeling.
It's all over the shop. So, all right. So military tribunes with consular power is the name of the game for 403.
Is it just? I feel like there are a lot of people.
There are many, many people. At the very least, there are six. Mm. And at the very most, a possible nine.
Wow. Yeah.
Just madness.
Well, you know, there is a lot of conflict going on right now.
Well, yeah.
And even they insist on telling us that it's not because of that, I feel like it is because of that.
There's definitely something going on.
There's something going on.
There's a bit of bloating at the top at this point.
Oh, yeah.
Six military tribunes, it's a lot. So we have Manius Aemilius Mamercinus.
A name I know well.
Or Mamercus. Mm-hmm. Nobody's sure about that one.
Yeah.
He was previously consul in 410.
Yes.
And was also a military tribune with consular power in 405.
Yeah.
So he's had a couple of tours of duty at the top.
Yes. And I think also this is a name that we're familiar with. I feel like it's a family name that's been passed down. Because we've had a guy with a very similar name before who's been involved in some stuff.
Yeah. And the Aemilii Gens is one of these well-known.
Absolutely.
We've got these famous families and this list is populated exclusively with very famous families.
Absolutely. Well, are you suggesting that it shouldn't be a patrician? Like,
I mean, the whole point when they said they were going to have military tribunes was to allow plebeians to have a go, and that's never happened.
Clearly just a gesture.
Lies.
Exactly. To make people feel like they had a say. But
I hate it when they do that.
All right. So we've got Aemilius.
Number two is Lucius Valerius Potitus.
Ooh, okay, yes.
Also a military tribune with consular power previously in 414 and 406.
Ooh, the notable year.
The notable year. Mm. So maybe popular pants.
Well, the Valerii are generally a pretty popular family, aren't they?
They with seem the to be. Yeah. Yeah. Then we have Appius Claudius Crassus Inregulensis.
Boo! Hiss!
The Claudii are back in town.
Oh, yeah. It's been too long, to be honest. I've actually been kind of missing their presence as villains in our story.
Yeah, my note here is cool, cool, cool.
Yeah. I love it.
Great, fantastic. So glad for that. Marcus Quintilius Varus.
Okay, new kid on the block.
Number four.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And then number five, Lucius Iulius Volpius. Piskey, maybe Eulis. There's a whole bunch of, I feel like some complicated names in there.
Yeah, whenever we mention someone with the Eulis name, I feel like there's always like a question mark Eulis. Yeah. Extra name.
Yeah, like there's a refinement within the family tree.
Or maybe Eulis. They were like, are their parents this cruel?
Eulis Eulis.
Yeah, what a name.
And then we have Marcus Furius Fusus.
Thank God. The Furii have really been dropping the ball, if I'm being honest.
They're back.
Yeah.
So back.
And yet here we sit in our Furii t-shirts, ready for action.
Oh, I'm so excited. So these are the six who we feel relatively confident, and confidence is a pretty low measure of things when it comes to this period in Roman history.
Sure.
Because we've got the Fasti Capitolini is essentially the source for these names, and we know it was created late.
I actually have the perfect analogy for this. It's about as confident as I feel in a bikini.
Oh, no.
That's not much, listeners, not much.
But you look great. And then we've got these three other figures who...
Shadowy.
Yeah. Mm. They don't appear on the Fasti. Also, it seems weird that they have to be somewhere because they do things in this year.
Sure.
The first one is Marcus Postumius. And this might be a real furphy of a figure because we're about to have another Marcus Postumius Albinus Regulensis.
I did notice that there were two.
The same guy, but one we don't know their full name?
Yeah.
But the really important one out of these three is Marcus Furius Camillus.
See, suspicious because... why do we have two sets of guys with very similar names? I know Camillus is the guy that you're reading about in Plutarch.
Mm-hmm.
So I know he's a thing. But it's just weird to have two sets of guys with very similar names and question marks around some of them.
Yeah. So we've got that Marcus Furius Fusus as a military tribune.
Yeah.
Then we've got our Marcus Furius Camillus.
Yeah.
You're like, okay, well, I mean, they are different names, but it's only one name that's different. All right. Okay.
Yeah.
That's possible. But is it what's going on? And then the two Marcus Postumii.
Yeah.
Yeah. So we've got lots of questions. And not only that, those last three that have the question marks around them as potential military tribunes with consular power, two of them may have also have served as censors.
Right.
With more question marks there.
Yeah, yeah, definitely. It's not just question marks about whether they were censors. I mean, we have question marks about how official any of these sorts of positions really are. I know that it was actually quite a while ago that we did an episode about the census in the Republic. But nonetheless, there are questions about, are the Romans really at this early stage regularly taking a census? Are they?
Are they?
Yeah.
These are the things that, again, you know, we're just not sure about.
Yeah.
There's definitely been instances where the census has been referenced before.
Sure.
That we've discussed.
Absolutely, yeah.
Whether they're doing a census now, open to question. Whether these two guys are the censors, even bigger questions, because the way that we understand the census from later periods when we've got much better evidence is that the censorship is kind of this additional magistracy that sits above and beyond and slightly outside of the cursus honorum.
Yes.
But it tends to be the kind of position that you only take up once you've reached that whole threshold within the cursus honorum. So it would be usually given to somebody extremely wise, extremely powerful, somebody who's had the consulship before. And in this case, we've got a couple of what appear to me maybe no names coming through.
How dare you? He's a Furii.
Oh, yeah. But even so.
No, I know what you mean. It'd be weird to be starting your career with this, which is what it seems like.
That's the way that the evidence is presenting itself right now.
Yeah.
And that makes us wonder, what do we know about the censorship really in this period, which is not a lot? How does that compare to the later version of the censorship? We're not sure. And who is this Camillus character anyway? Well,
exactly. And I mean, I think one of the things we can say about the censors and the census in this period is that, look, if I was going to bet on anything, it'd be that they're taking account of the citizens, because that just makes good sense. But as for the other powers that a censor has, they're the ones I have real questions about. So,
I'm looking forward to the sorts of details that Livy might have on this. And so then I can share with you the really bizarre details that I think I might have on this.
Well, let me tell you, 403 is another bumper year. It's kind of like the way that I make my stepkids have like only big birthdays every 3 years. 406 was a big year, now 403 is a big year. Sorry, stepkids. Anyway, all right, so let me set the scene for you a little bit and you can jump in with your Plutarch and your Valerius Maximus when you feel the need.
Mm.
So peace was to be found everywhere in Italy, except between Rome and they.
Wow. Okay, well, that does not explain 6 military tribunes with consular power.
No. Now, as we've said, we know that there was conflict brewing in this quarter that has been bubbling away for the last couple of years, okay? Hence, potentially, the military pay may be becoming a feature, right? So by this point, after a few years, they're both incredibly worked up. And I'm sorry, I'm just going to have to use this analogy. It's a Harry Potter and Voldemort situation. One of them has to go. They can't both survive at the moment. It's just at that point. It's going to be a war to the death this time.
Da, da, da.
Exactly. So both cities hold their different kinds of elections. Romans decided that they were going to go for military tribunes, as you've noted, and even Livy notes that there were more than usual. He gives me the number of 8.
Oh, okay. Well, out of a possible 9. Interesting.
Exactly, exactly. Now, the people of Veii, they're channeling a bit of the feelings that the Romans had not so long ago, which is that they are OVA campaigning. Year in, year out, it's just military service, it's just fighting. So they decide that a way of dealing with this situation would be to elect a king.
Oh.
I know.
Fascinating.
I know, right?
Well, I mean, so the Etruscans have kings.
We know they've had kings, yeah.
They've had kings before.
It's an option.
Yeah. I didn't know they weren't doing it all the time.
Well, yes, this is the interesting thing, isn't it? Yes. And the other interesting detail I can add here is that the rest of the Etruscan people, because of course Veii is just one city out of many Etruscan cities, 12 in fact, and the other Etruscan people are horrified. They hate the idea of kings, apparently, and they also personally dislike the person who was elected. So it's a double whammy.
That suggests that the politics of the Etruscans has really progressed since we last checked in with how they were running their show.
I was going to say, they seemed very upset when Lars Tolumnius died.
He was a king.
Exactly.
That wasn't that long ago.
It was not that long ago. I mean, for us, it was years ago, of course, but for them, it was decades ago. Yeah, it is a bit strange, and it feels like, yeah.
Is this a narrative of convenience, Livy?
Look, it seems like it's been about 35 years since we've had an Etruscan king mentioned in a way that we can, you know, be certain about. Yeah. Yeah, and nothing has been said about, you know, the Etruscans going down the Roman path of swearing that as God is their witness, they'll never have kings again.
I'm throwing you out and you're staying out.
Yeah. So it seems like maybe the Romans are just assuming that everybody hates kings as much as they do. But it does also imply this weird thing that kings are somehow an optional accessory in the Etruscan state.
Maybe they are an optional accessory, maybe, but it doesn't sound like anybody in Etruria is very happy about that.
No, it's just so weird. But anyway, now the reason why...
It is a time of crisis.
Yeah, this is true. Maybe their option of king is a bit like the Roman option of dictator. Maybe that's what it's about. But who knows? Unfortunately, Livy gives me no more detail. He just goes on to trash the king in question. Now, the reason why he was disliked was that he was super duper wealthy and arrogant. What a terrible combination.
I don't know why you'd put somebody like that in power.
I know. Now, on top of that, his actions suggest that he's just not really of a very kingly character. He had busted up a very serious sacred religious festival. I mean, that's sacrilege, Dr. G. Literally.
Yeah. Okay, so the gods aren't on Vey's side at this point.
It would seem that this is where we're going because, yeah, basically he was just angry about some perceived slight politically, and so he was in a bad mood and he decided he was going to ruin the gods' good time.
Okay. Do we have this guy's name?
No, I don't think so. So anyway, he's not happy about the fact that the Etruscans had chosen someone else to be priest instead of him. He lets this get the better of him. Clearly somebody whose emotions are not under control, which means it's weird that if they're only electing a king in a time of crisis, they turn to this guy.
Yeah, you're not putting the best man in for the job.
No.
No wonder the rest of the Etruria is up in arms being like, are you idiots?
Yeah. And the Etruscans, as we know, the stereotype is in Roman sources that they are very religious, like more religious than the Romans. I mean, Livy basically gives me the impression in this account that they live for nothing but religion.
Well, and a lot of Roman ritual seems to have been passed through in from that cultural lens of the Etruscans
yes,
as well. So
absolutely,
you can definitely see where that idea might come from.
Oh, for sure. Look, there's no denying that the Etruscans were religious people, but we know that it's something of a stereotype that they are, you know. It's like saying the ancient Egyptians lived for religion. Like, yeah, it was very important. It was very central. But we have to also remember that's also just the kind of stuff that survived from their civilization, you know. The big stone temples and whatnot. Yes, they did take it very seriously, but we are only looking at part of the puzzle here. So I'm always a bit, you know, hesitant about that kind of stuff. But as we know, they're also very big into like religious rites, making sure that they are followed through properly. So this kind of thing, just not okay in the Etruscan rulebook, according to the Romans.
What a lens.
Yeah. Now, the Etruscans decided as a people, like as in collectively, that they were not going to assist Vey in any conflicts if they insisted on having a king. They actually took a vote on it.
Wow. Okay. You're out on your own.
Yep. You absolutely are.
Oh, boy.
The people of Vey did not tell the king this because they were really worried that given his temper, he was going to shoot the messenger.
Seems like this is going to lead to some future problems.
Yeah. He basically would have seen anyone who told him this as the head of some secret rebel conspiracy against him, rather than someone who was just simply reporting what had happened.
Oh, dear.
Yes. So the Romans hear about this. And this is obviously good news for the Romans because they now know that Vey is kind of on their own. However, they're also aware that that might not always be the case. And clearly, they're kind of aware that this is going to be a long game situation. Just in case they decide, whilst they're doing their sieging, that they're going to build double fortifications. One set looking to Vey and one set looking in the general direction of Etruria. Which, to be honest, I feel like they're both to the north, but
very similar positions.
Yeah. Just in case they decided, like once things started getting real, that they were going to come to Vey's aid after all.
Okay, so is the idea here that these fortifications are relatively close to Vey as opposed to Rome? Rome's not taking a defensive position here, but more they're putting a forward fortification in place to enable them to have a position to easily attack from?
I wish Livy gave me that much detail. I don't really know, but the way it's described, it does kind of sound like it might be defensive fortifications for Rome.
All right.
Perhaps. And that's why maybe the slightly different directions. Because obviously, if you were literally at Vey, why would you build double fortifications? You know, if you're literally on the doorstep.
Well, it means that you can have like sort of an encampment that's
I suppose
defended.
So. Yeah, that's true. Yeah. They are setting up an encampment. So.
I'm not a terrible military strategist.
Clearly, I do not know what I'm talking about.
I mean,
about
I
either,
might be, but
I know that they are obviously deciding on a siege.
Okay, so if we're thinking about the position of Vey relative to the position of the rest of Etruria.
Yeah.
Vey is directly north, not very far away.
No.
So you could have something that's sort of positioned at the edge of the Tiber River, presumably on Rome's side as a defensive fortification. But you could also have something off to the northeast, potentially on the side of the Janiculum, that would allow a sort of a more advanced forward defense fortification.
Let's run with that. The Romans seem to know what they're doing, so I'm going to assume that they're being smart about it.
Let's hope so.
Yes. Now, this is obviously an interesting situation because once again, we do have this division between the Etruscans, you know, that they're not automatically going to fight together. Now, we've seen this before. It's very clear that each of the 12 Etruscan civilizations are free to act independently. It's not something you can assume that they're going to all come together and come to your aid and that sort of thing. However, it does show obviously the common bond between them, that they actually get together and vote on these sorts of issues, as well as having religious celebrations, which can be interrupted.
So it's a well-functioning league of states, essentially.
Yes, exactly, yeah. All right, so the Roman generals who are in charge, they have decided upon a siege, not just a straight attack at Veii. Therefore, the soldiers are going to be setting up winter quarters, which they have not apparently done before.
Well, that doesn't make sense according to 406 BCE.
This is the thing. I think this is how these stories are connected. And look, I told you the chronology is messy at this point in time and things might not be happening quite when Livy says they are or in quite the order, etc., etc. But this is exactly what the plebeians had been suspicious about, some of the plebeians, I should say, when military pay was introduced. They're kind of like, guys, this stuff isn't coming to you for free. Like, there's always going to be strings attached. The patricians aren't just randomly nice, even though that's what you seem to be taking away from this situation.
I'm shivering in this new camp that they made, and even though they pay me, I don't know if it's worth losing all my toes.
Dear Lucretia, I don't know whose idea it was for us to wear sandals all the time, but I hate it. And why do we wear skirts? God damn it.
My balls are freezing.
All right. So people in Rome hear about this decision and they are not happy about it.
Fair enough.
Specifically, the Tribune of the Plebs.
Oh, I have no named characters to fulfill this role this year.
I don't have named characters either.
They're just out and about. Yeah. I mean, I assume they exist.
Yeah. I don't know who the Tribunes actually are, except for the fact that they are once again troublesome.
Unhappy with the situation.
Yeah, exactly. So Livy says that it's because everything had actually been quite fine and they'd been given nothing to be upset about that they decided to make a mountain out of a molehill about this whole issue, because they needed to find something to be upset about, because otherwise the plebeians weren't going to be unhappy with the patricians and things would be peaceful.
I don't know about that. You've just told them that they're going to have to overwinter as part of this new military strategy. I feel like the plebs are pretty capable of being upset all by themselves.
Pish tosh, Dr. G. It's quite clearly a situation of things being spun so that they look much worse than they actually are.
Oh, Livy, revealing your conservative leanings.
Exactly, yeah. So the Tribunes of the Plebs decide that this is something they could make the plebeians angry about. So they start doing that. They start pointing out, we told you, strings attached. Those are strings, Pinocchio. We told you that there would be some reason that money was being introduced for military service. We knew it. We knew it. We told you so. We're going to do the I told you so dance, because they had suspected the patricians would never do something just to be nice. Young men are clearly going to be required now to serve endlessly. Where's the time for self-care? Where's the time for family? Where is the work-life balance? Winter has now been taken away from us. It's not coming. It's going. And why? Why? Because the patricians were trying to get virile young plebeians out of the city so they could not campaign for anything or help the plebeians as a group. These were going to be the young men who were sent off to Veii, of course. They're going to be worse off than the people in Veii because clearly they're going to be left defenseless and alone.
It is bad times, and I can see that maybe the Tribune of the Plebs have an interest in, like, whipping up the plebeians, of course.
Oh, yeah. And they're not done yet either. There's more.
I'm still having the vision of them dancing on, like, the rostra, being like, it's happening. We foreshadowed it. It's happening now. And everybody being like, boo.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Well, they point out that the people of Veii, because they're the ones being besieged, they get to live in their own houses. They get to live behind their own walls. Where are the plebeians going to be? Out in the middle of frickin' nowhere shivering. That's where, Dr. G.
The convenience of being the besieged.
I know. The ones enduring food shortages and famine, potentially. I don't know. So the Roman soldiers are going to have the pressure of being constantly on the watch, on the job. And they're doing it in winter conditions. Oh, you wait for it, Dr. G. They're going to whip out the S word. This is slavery.
Oh my God.
Yeah, not even the kings, not even the consuls. And I'm talking about the consuls before there was the option, technically, of military tribunes with consular power where plebeians could technically run for office, but they never get it. Okay? Dictators, decemvirs, none of them, as bad as they were, had dared to treat the plebeians like this, keeping them at war always? What?
Who's going to grow the food?
Yeah.
Who's going to defend the city if another enemy, like, I don't know, the Volscii show up?
Oh, and you haven't even thought of the worst situation, Dr. G. What if the men now trying to impose these conditions on the people ever became actual consuls instead of military tribunes with consular power? Or, worse yet, dictators? Dear God, it would be a bloodbath. But, of course, Dr. G, the plebeians kind of deserved it. Because after all,
what?
They have yet to elect a single plebeian to the office of military tribune with consular power. And now they were flanked by 8 patrician options. What the actual hell?
Is this the argument that the tribune of the plebs are putting forward?
Yes.
Being like, you've had your chance and this is what you've done.
Oh,
you've
done nothing.
I'm
still channeling their voice. Okay. If you thought these were my points of view, no. You thought I just got mad.
I was like, she's lost it.
Trump finally got to her. No. No, this is what they're saying. They're like, couldn't there be just 1 out of 8 to remind the patricians that the plebeians would like to see their families from time to time? End of story.
We just need a seat at the table, guys.
Yeah.
And you didn't do it. You never voted anyone in.
Exactly. And you know what, to be honest, if things are happening the way that they say, I actually do not blame them. However, as we know, it seems super suspicious that the plebeians would never elect one of their own. Like, it's just been too long at this point in time. And this is one of those things where we have to suspect the narrative of the conflict of the orders. It just doesn't make sense.
It is a problematic narrative in many respects.
Mm.
And I think also part of our issue is that we would love to know more about how the voting system actually worked at this point in time. But it's very early days in terms of the Republican system.
Yeah.
And the very concept of saying that there is a Republican system is maybe too soon for that.
Absolutely.
So is it the case that the plebeians are not in a position politically, in terms of the nature of the voting, to be able to get up one of their own?
I suspect that's what it is.
I feel like if we look at the way that voting systems turn out in the later republic, that might be part of the explanation. But it's also, it just seemed weird. I mean, from Livy's sort of rhetorical perspective, because he's definitely bringing some, like, you know, big, bold characterizations here.
For sure.
Some sweeping brushstrokes, which I quite like, of the drama.
Oh, it's good. It's good stuff.
It is. There's this suggestion that there is this ongoing process of struggle that sits behind everything.
Yes.
And so that question about what is going on here is never really fully resolved from a historian's perspective.
I think that's exactly it. As we've often highlighted, I just find it hard to believe that if the plebeians truly are, A, outnumbering the patricians, which seems likely given everything we've been told, and B, able to elect one of their own to the most prestigious office in the state, it just seems so unlikely that they wouldn't have done it at least once in the past, 45 years or something, that they've been able to do it. It just doesn't make sense. There has to be something else going on here, which, if we look at the voting system, as you say, it might be that technically the rich, their vote counts for more or something like that. Who knows? But it's got to be something like that.
That certainly plays into later understandings of voting systems. But
yes. Yeah.
Yeah. Interesting.
But who knows? Yeah. Who
interesting
knows?
And dramatic.
I know. I think the thing reason why I have to highlight it is because it's just so disgusting that Livy makes it their fault that they're in this situation.
Way to victim blame, Livy.
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah. It's like, you know, you can't afford to turn the heating on for your family. You can't afford good food for your family. Well, it's clearly your fault for being poor. I just find those narratives so similar to some that we hear today as well.
Completely demeaning and inappropriate.
Exactly. Now, you may have noticed that the way I was speaking just then, you did notice that it's kind of odd because I wasn't actually giving you like a speech per se and there was no one named, right?
Mm-hmm.
Lean into that because I think that's also I think that's also a rhetorical device because we're about to have a response that goes four paragraphs to what the Tribunes of the Plebs said, which is just reported. It's not an actual speech.
Okay.
It's like Livy paraphrasing what they're talking about.
Okay.
And they are unnamed.
And he's now going to give a real, like a speech in quotation marks as far as he's concerned.
Yeah. He's now giving a speech, flesh rabbits. Boing, boing, boing. To none other than Appius Claudius.
Oh, no.
It's back, baby. Well, I mean, he's not, but
yeah.
That family is back.
The boys are back in town. Well, I can't wait to hear what a Claudii has to say on this matter.
Yeah, now look, you're going to need to strap yourself in. It is quite a long speech. So basically, one of the reasons, obviously, for having 8 military tribunes with consular power is that some of them obviously need to be off setting up the siege against Fae, dealing with that kind of stuff. But you can't leave the people of Rome completely unattended, especially if they're mostly plebeians. Who knows what they get up to, Dr. G. And therefore, some military tribunes had been left behind specifically to snuff out any potential treachery. And it's just as well they did, because the Tribunes of the Plebs played right into their hands.
Oh, boy. Yeah. All right. Okay, that's the setup. It's not the case that you would want to have a military tribune located in Rome like you do almost every year that we've had military tribunes.
Exactly.
Just in case somebody comes up from another area and attempts to attack Rome.
It's got nothing to do with
while that. The other guys are out and about.
Nope. It's not normal. It's not normal. It's clearly something concerning.
There's something sinister going on.
Oh, there is. Now, Appius Claudius comes from a family very experienced with dealing with the Tribunes of the Plebs and their like, and their attempts to stir up trouble. Now, although this is not the famous Appius Claudius, in fact, there's been a couple of famous Appius Claudii that we have dealt with over the years. This is not one of the ones, you know, from the Decemvirate and that sort of thing, but these are their descendants. And therefore, as we have highlighted before, the Romans like to think they are very similar in character. This is a guy that we have mentioned before, though. He was the one who a few years ago suggested the strategy of turning the Tribunes of the Plebs against each other.
Oh, yeah. Okay. Yeah,
this
guy.
Is that guy. Yeah.
This Appius Claudius.
Yeah.
Okay.
Now, of course,
cut from the same cloth.
Educated Roman. He's got the gift of the gab, Dr. G. He's good with his rhetoric. And that's why he gets an actual speech, apparently, and a name.
Hmm.
There could now be no doubt that the Tribunes of the Plebs were not really working for the benefit of the plebeians. They're just troublemakers. It's obvious. Whenever there may have been something wrong with their lives, emphasis on the word may, the Tribunes of the Plebs just blow it all out of proportion and make it into such a big deal. Now, they were even stooping so low, Dr. G, that they were trying to spin something good into something evil. Military pay was designed by the patricians to restore peace to Roman society. But it is quite clear that the Tribunes of the Plebs just want to hate whatever the patricians do, regardless of whether it actually benefits the plebeians or not.
So ungrateful.
I know. The Tribunes of the Plebs only exist to solve political problems so they can then create them whenever they can, just so they can stay in a job.
If it's not dramatic, like, why are we here? I mean, the people don't need looking after if everything's good, right? So things must be bad.
Exactly. Now, the Tribunes of the Plebs jealously guard access to the plebeians and won't allow contact between the plebeians and the patricians because they don't want anyone realizing how kind and magnanimous and just freaking amazing the patricians actually are, because their loyalties might get transferred. They need to keep them angry and separated.
Are we talking about the same Claudii who have treated everybody so badly, so often, over successive generations?
They have not treated people badly.
And you're telling me this Claudii is now telling us that, you know, they've got a heart of gold and they've just been misunderstood.
I think you will find, if you examine the historical record, that the Claudii have been harsh but fair.
Oh, boy.
So he basically likens this, again, to slavery, interestingly, saying it's kind of like when the masters won't allow other people to interact with their slaves in any capacity, whether to, you know, beat them up or give them a little kiss or something, because they just don't want them exposed to, you know, any outside influences. That's what this situation is like. The tribunes of the plebs should clearly have spent some time fostering their kindly side. And by their, I mean the patricians' kindly side. And they should have been working on the plebeians' obedience.
Oh.
Harmony would be possible if the tribunes just, you know, got on the good side of the patricians and made the plebeians obey everything they said, clearly.
I think this whole argument rests on a fundamental misunderstanding of what the role of the tribune of the plebs might be.
Well, I think you'll change your mind because I've got quite some time to go. Now, if there was internal peace in Rome because the patricians and the plebeians were actually getting along with each other, the sky was the limit for Rome. It's this internal division that's holding them back. They would dominate everyone in the area. But alas, tribunes of the plebs.
Okay, all yeah. Right, Appius Claudius.
Now he gets the actual point of military pay. So the tribunes of the plebs were suggesting that no pay should be given now because it had not been given in the past. You remember that was one of the arguments they'd put forward in 406, that like, how are you going to, you know, back pay these people?
Yeah, how are you going to sustain this?
Exactly, unfair, blah, blah, blah. And he's like, but you are missing something here. It makes no sense to back pay because the work conditions are new. Therefore, it's a new situation. Therefore, new pay has been introduced. Things are just evolving in tandem with each other. And it's also normal for people to get paid for work.
Well, but surely it would also be normal for them to get paid for their regular summer military gig.
No, that is not the case. Because he's like, it's stupid that people who served previously and like volunteered for it are upset now. That is stupid. And that is because they got 6 months of the year off. They got to go home and see their families and farm and stuff. These guys aren't getting that. That is why they're getting pay. Okay, you can't have everything. Don't get greedy. Now soldiers are happy to receive pay. And in return, they should be okay with being away for a little longer. Just a touch.
Little icicles hanging off their mustaches.
Yeah. And this is just, oh my God, this just seems like something that someone today could easily say. It wouldn't be right if they got paid for a year's service but only worked half.
What?
So he's basically saying, like, if we introduce military pay but still allow them to go home for 6 months of the year, they'd effectively be getting pay for, like, a year's work, but they'd only be working for half. That's what he's suggesting here. Now, I know what you're going to say. Logically, why not just pay them a little less and pay them for 6 months? Don't get carried away with logic.
Have they considered having a two levy system where they've got the summer army and the winter army and they rotate, and people who want to get paid sign up for the winter army and people who just like to swan around in the sunshine volunteer for summer military work?
You know what, Dr. G? I'm at a point in the speech where Appius is getting uncomfortable talking about money.
Classic patrician.
It's crass. It's mercenary and crass.
It's time to move on to something else. This point is not being persuasive with the crowd.
His point is that we shouldn't really be talking about money because, quite frankly, this is a civic issue. You're a citizen of this place, are you not? And therefore, why are we even paying you?
Yeah.
It makes you seem like a mercenary.
Yeah, you're just doing your civic duty.
Exactly.
Defending Rome so we can all enjoy it.
Yeah. Why are we even bothering to be nice to you? We are the state. We are the government. It's just a fact that Rome should not have started the war, or should just get on with it like Rome would, which is awesome, obviously, and get it over with ASAP. I mean, we all know that Rome is going to win. Now, that's a very convenient argument because
the quicker get this done, the less we have to pay you.
it's great for him to say, well, clearly Rome shouldn't have started the war if this is going to be an issue, but we have, so we've just got to continue. Surely the Romans are fired up about Vey. Surely they want to finish the war for that reason alone. All of Greece was happy to fight for 10 years over one woman. What is Rome's excuse at the moment? The Romans aren't even in that bad a situation. They're barely away from home. They is really close, and it's all going to be over really soon. Stop your complaining.
I love how he's brought in a reference to the Trojan War, when literally the Peloponnesian War was right there.
I think it's just, you know, that the Roman historians are leaning into the parallels to the Trojan War. They're making this their epic. So.
And there is no woman, and I'm disappointed because we don't get to talk about women in ancient Rome enough right now.
That's true.
They're teasing us.
Seven times, Dr. G. Seven times they have started a war.
Oh, Rome's been counting.
Well, Appius, Claudius has.
Okay, all right.
Yeah. They never mean it when they forge truces, clearly, because otherwise why would they have multiple wars?
Yeah, I mean, the six other wars explains that one.
They keep invading Roman territory. They keep raiding Roman fields.
Rude.
They was behind the betrayal of Fidenae and the Roman settlers who were killed there and the murder of the Roman envoys. Oh, yes, we're going all the way back there. Yeah. They tried to turn all of Etruria against Rome, and to this day, they want nothing more than for Rome to be wiped from the face of the earth.
Well,
they only just recently, after all, were rude to the Roman ambassadors. Ambassadors. Don't know why I put an N in there. And threatened them with death. Clearly.
Rude. Also rude, yeah.
Yeah, clearly.
Yeah.
Rome should be giving 110% when fighting such utter bastards. They is in a vulnerable spot. Rome needs to take advantage of this. They're surrounded, Dr. G. Now is the time. They've not been able to harvest or farm, because after all, this whole situation has been going on for a while now. So if Rome withdraws, of course, they is just going to go back to plundering Roman territory because they need the resources. So Rome would not really get out of a war if they backed off now, but rather would find war moved into their own territory.
Now, for all that Appius Claudius...
That does actually kind of make
sense. Yeah. ...is a terrible human.
Yeah.
He makes some good points there.
That's some good points. And he also points out, how would the soldiers feel about this situation? After all the siege stuff they've built, after all the defences, so much effort, are they just going to leave all of that behind until the next season? Which makes me think that, you know, what we were talking about before, that it must be like close to Bay and this stuff. It's obviously at risk if they leave.
I think so. Yeah. Like they've set up some equipment already, I think.
Yeah.
That would be my assumption. And if they've already started a siege process, then they would have set up some landworks for support them.
Yeah. Apologies to all the military historians out there. I know that we don't do a great job with this. Mind you, Livy could do better too.
Well, I think this is the thing, is that we're reading Livy. Livy has whatever extensive knowledge that he might have about certain areas, but I'm not sure that military matters are necessarily his strong suit. No. And also, as an analytic historian, he does tend to storyize.
That's true.
That's not really a word, but you know what I mean. Storify the military encounters in such a way that you don't seem to have a sense of confidence about where things were anyway, necessarily.
This is true. He has given me no geographic markers. So, in other words, the soldiers would be upset because they've gone to all this effort of constructing all this stuff and they're just going to have to leave it there and then do all that hard work all over again next season. Why not just stay in place and push on until it's all over? And what else might a delay lead to? Right now, the Etruscans are not willing to help Vey. But what if their feelings change over time? The Etruscans are mad right now about that whole anonymous king issue. But what if negotiations change that down the road? There are a lot of things to consider and a lot of potential repercussions, people. The tribunes of the plebs are just being weak. It's like dealing with a sick person who needs a strict routine in order to get better. But the tribunes of the plebs, they want you to follow a path where you're just going to make your illness worse and last longer and perhaps make it more serious by giving in to requests for food and drink when clearly what you need is nothing, no sustenance. Do not feed this problem. He's not done yet.
Oh, no. I was like, oh, he's building up to something. Maybe it's the end.
It is going. Even putting aside the actual war, it is important for Roman soldiers to get used to persevering, to sticking around until the job is done and not leaving when victory is close just because they're off the clock.
You guys haven't been trying hard enough.
Well, he's saying, are you suggesting that the Roman soldiers are not tough enough to endure winter? I think you'll find that they are. The Romans are the toughest. The soldiers would also be embarrassed to find that people thought they were so weak they couldn't handle a little snow. Rome also needs to consider its wider reputation.
Here we go.
If they become known as those people who won't see a siege through, well, they're hardly scary, are they?
It's just going to encourage the Volscii.
Yeah.
And the Aquians and the Sabines.
Yeah.
And anybody else who's ever had a problem.
Exactly. So the tribunes of the plebs, if you look at it from this perspective, Dr. G, and I am looking at it from Appius Claudius' perspective, are really on the side of the enemies of Rome. They want to throw Vey a lifeline here. The people of Vey would be thrilled to hear of internal problems in Rome and in its army. Vey right now seems unified, you know, in its own little way. After all, they even have a king. They're not worried. They're not even breaking a sweat. And that's without help from the Etruscans. May I remind you once more? Normally, Romans who run away from battle would be beaten to death with a cudgel. But the Romans are so used to hearing outrageous things from the tribunes of the plebs that they are thinking about this possibility, even though technically it's about betraying Rome. The tribunes of the plebs only need to take that final step and basically poison the army and get them to turn on their commanders.
Wow.
Yeah. That's it. That's their next port of call. They're going to go to the army. They're going to turn them against the commanders. That's clearly where this is headed. Yeah.
Okay. So this is some strong rhetoric coming through from Appius Claudius.
Yeah.
Not only are the tribune of the plebs obstructive, but they are now enemies of the state. They are hostis.
Absolutely.
In the Latin way of talking about these things. Yep. Intense.
Yep. Liberty in Rome, Dr. G, clearly means that there is no respect. No respect at all. Not for the Senate. Not for the magistrates. Not for the laws. Not for ancestral customs. Not for institutions of the Senate. Or military discipline. This is where it's led us. It's madness, I tell you, madness.
We might as well fold up shop and I will just die right here because it would be a faster way to go than the slow death that they're setting us up for.
Yeah. Now, be relieved to hear that Appius Claudius is finally done for the moment.
And in the back corner of the forum, a whole bunch of patricians being like, woo! And tribunes of the plebs off to one side being like,
exactly. Now, all of this rhetoric, all of these points, which we admit, not all are bad. Some have some logic to them, but some of them, oh boy.
Some of them are very strong appeals to emotions.
Yeah. He is doing well, though, against the tribunes of the plebs. Okay. His speech is obviously quite persuasive.
To whom? Oh, patricians. All right. Fine.
Well, this is the thing. That speech was probably given in the Senate, I would say. But we get the feeling that he's giving similar types of speeches to anyone who will listen. But anyway, he's doing quite well. He's, I think, causing definitely enough confusion that the plebeians are like, oh, hang on a second.
Oh, wait a minute.
Wait, just a cutting pick a second. Then something went wrong at Vey.
Oh.
Yeah. So, as we know, there is nothing that brings the Roman people together more than when they're facing an external enemy. This is pretty much what happens. This gives Appius the edge over the tribunes of the plebs and like his arguments and that sort of thing because something goes wrong on the Vey front. And the patricians and the plebeians start to be more unified in their purpose because they understand that they need more energy at the siege. Allow me to tell you what was happening at Vey. So, The soldiers had apparently pushed forward the terrace towards the town. Now, I can only mean that this is some sort of siege equipment that is getting very close to Vey itself.
Move the turret.
Yeah.
Push the wooden rabbit further.
Yes. To the point where the mantlets of this terrace are practically touching the walls. Now, for anybody who's even familiar with like medieval siege warfare, I think you could kind of picture the kind of equipment that they are using here. It's the same kind of terminology you sometimes get coming through for like castles and the kind of siege equipment you get for that as well and that sort of thing. Right. Mantlets are basically designed to protect any attackers from projectiles that might be thrown at them. So like they're the little bits that, you know, come up in the middle from like a dip. It's hard to describe in a podcast. So just take my word for it.
Okay. So this is allowing the advancing force of the siege.
Yes. To go forward.
To go forward, be somewhat protected, get a little bit closer and hopefully do something that's going to disturb that wall or disturb the defenders on the wall.
Yeah. And they seem to be doing pretty well.
Okay.
However, the army are focusing very much on building up their siege equipment. So, you know, they're working hard, constructing as much as possible during the day, but they neglected to watch them overnight. And then all of a sudden,
that's
one
not
evening,
very Roman of them.
I know, it seems really stupid. Maybe they thought they were too big. I don't know. But all of a sudden, one evening, the people of Vey suddenly throw open the gates. A huge number of soldiers rush out with torches, set fire to all the siege equipment, and just in like an hour, all their work building up the terrace and the mantlets and all that kind of stuff went up in flames, which tells me that it was wooden or something. Plus, Romans died trying to put the fire out and save them.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah.
This is bad news.
Yes. And this is the news that really gives Appius the edge. Because obviously the Romans find out about this. Everyone feels very sad. The Senate is feeling very worried. They're like, what if we have to continue to deal with this endless questioning of the military pay? What if the tribunes of the plebs decide to try and use this development to their advantage, bragging that the, you know, the war effort was all falling apart anyway? Like, who knows what they're going to do with it? Suddenly, men in equestrian circles, but who did not have horses from the state.
Oh.
A specific group.
Very true equestrians. They got their own horses.
Yes. Came to the Senate. They had had a meeting, apparently. The meeting of the men who are equestrians but don't have horses from the state have their own horses.
Are these the knights who say knee?
Exactly. They had talked and they decided they were going to volunteer to serve using their own horses.
Well, that's very generous of them.
Isn't it just? The Senate is overcome and gives them an official vote of thanks. The people hear what is happening in the Forum and the city of Rome, and they rush to the courier because the plebs don't want to be outdone by these jerks on horses. The infantry now want to do something special too, and they declare, "We will go anywhere, kill anyone. Whatever you want, just tell us. We'll do it. And if Vey is a location, well then, by God, we'll stay at our post until that city is taken."
They're like the problematic second child who feels like they never really had enough of dad's love.
Exactly. The Senate, I actually think this is probably a high point. I don't think they've ever been so ridiculously happy that they've got people throwing military service at them and saying, "We'll do whatever it takes, whatever you want." They were so happy that it couldn't even just be taken care of with like a formal vote of thanks. They did not formally call the plebs into the courier to hear their response. Instead, the senators overflowed onto the steps outside the courier. They're going into the street, Dr. G.
They're thanking them in person.
Each senator personally called out or sign to the people how happy they were. Get out the party poppers. It's time for a celebration. The general message of the senators is that Rome was a blessed place. And because of the kind of people that live there, they were going to live forever. No one was ever going to beat Rome because they were unified. They were getting along. The senators love the equestrians. The senators love the plebeians. The senators love this day. You know what? You have outdone even us, the patricians, for being awesome, sweet, kind, and well-intentioned. Because I'm happy. And basically, this is where this all kind of starts to wrap up for me. The patricians and the plebs all are out there crying from happiness together until the Senate say, this is really nice and all, but like warfare.
Time
is money. Time is money.
It's been nice and all. I've just got this vision of senators like doing slightly awkward hugs of plebeians because they're kind of like, I don't know when you last washed.
Yeah. Or like just like getting out like a finger, like an index finger and like poking them on the forehead and being like, boop.
You're so cute. You did it.
So what this means, Dr. G, and this is how 403 kind of wraps up for me. The military tribunes obviously need to hold a formal assembly to just thank everyone and tell them that the Senate will forever remember and treasure this display of loyalty to the state. And they voted that all of these new volunteers who were not technically required to serve at this point should be paid.
Oh my God.
I know. And the equestrians were also granted money allowances, making this the first time that the cavalry began to serve on their own horses, but receive money from the state for their expenses. It's like an expense account kind of thing, you know, like reimbursing them and that kind of stuff. So these new volunteers, they went to Vey. They were on such a high that not only did they very quickly rebuild what had been lost, but they built even more. So the Romans were pumping out the provisions with so much enthusiasm, it was scary. Because the Romans back home, after seeing everything that's been happened, they wanted to take just the bestest, bestest care ever of the bestest, bestest army that ever lived. The end.
Wow. Okay. So some queries and concerns. So when we're talking about building siege equipment in this period, this is vast amounts of manual labor.
You underestimate how much happiness can help.
But even in the original complement of the siege equipment that they're trying to put together, Livy makes it sound like there's quite a lot. All right, like there's substantial fires, people die trying to put out those fires to save that equipment.
Yeah.
So you have to keep in mind that we're talking about cutting down trees.
Right.
That's labor. Uh-huh. Turning it into things. Mm-hmm. That's labor.
Mm.
Making sure that it really works. Turning trees into things. I think that's labor. I made this siege tower completely out of wood. Incredible. All it will take is one fiery arrow. Disaster.
Mm.
And all of that is happening. So they're denuding parts of the landscape in the area.
Which
presumably.
I do not care for. No.
Well, I mean, it's
necessary.
It's to be expected. There's lots of forest, I assume, much more in Italy then than there is now.
Yeah, no, I know.
But the sheer manpower required for all of that is phenomenal.
Absolutely.
So the idea that happiness could replace all of that lost equipment within the year.
It's not just happiness, it's tears of joy and song.
They sang while they worked.
Because I'm happy.
Look, I mean, I understand that there is some joy, but the senators themselves aren't doing any of the work, are they? It's all the volunteers. So the organization of the manpower is substantial.
Yeah.
You think of the logistics of that, getting them all out there, getting that work done, building, rebuilding everything, essentially.
Yeah.
Turning up to that encampment for the first moment to realize
that
you're looking at a burnt field, essentially, of the things that used to exist. Like, this is tough work.
I think you're getting caught up on technicalities.
I'm just trying to make this, give it a sense of maybe if this is real.
Mm.
Okay, let's say we're in a period of time where people are doing this kind of stuff.
Whoa. If this is real? I didn't just spend the last hour talking to you on the assumption that this was fiction.
Well, and no. And in the sense that this is a historical podcast, you know. Obviously, something happened in the past. Was it this? I have some questions. Anyway.
Look, to be fair, okay, and this is where I'm going to let you off the hook a little bit here. I've just enjoyed watching you try and put it together. He doesn't actually give me a time frame.
All right.
Okay, so when he says that this is what happened, he may not have meant it happened all in this one year. He might have meant that this is something that because of what happened in this year, this is what was possible. Mm-mm. So this is what the Romans will achieve. Eventually.
All right. I think this dovetails nicely into the small amounts of source material I currently have available.
I hope it's another long speech from Appius Claudius.
Certainly not. I can reassure you on that point.
Excellent.
I have Diodorus Siculus, mm-hmm. who gives us a few of the characters and military tribunes.
Okay.
Gets some of the names right. Doesn't get the number right. That's fine.
Well, I don't know that we can say anybody got the number right, can we?
But then we also have this side quest, if you like, mm-hmm. of what is happening with Camillus.
Ah, yes. See, oddly, doesn't,
doesn't get
account.
Mentioned in Livy at all.
My account.
And for me, this was the most exciting part of this year because we have somebody mentioned who's going to become really quite significant.
Absolutely, yeah.
I'm not going to give the game away about why.
But he's definitely like up there on like a Coriolanus kind of level.
Yeah, he's going to, watch this space. Camillus is going to be a thing.
Yeah.
So Camillus comes to us for the first time. So I'm going to start off with things that I like to do, which is delving into the name.
Yes, please do.
So his full name, mm-hmm. as far as we understand it, is Marcus Furius, son of Lucius.
Love a Furius.
Grandson of Spurius, Camillus, which means that his father was Lucius Furius.
But his
and his grandfather was Spurius Furius.
That t-shirt paid off.
Never let it be forgotten that we were there first.
Absolutely.
Spurius Furius.
Yeah.
So there are a couple of Spurii Furii out there.
Yeah.
So it's important to, hone in on who was who.
Yes.
And really we're talking about the father being likely to have been Lucius Furius Medullinus.
Okay.
So he was a military tribune with consular power in 432.
I was going to say I recognize that name because it always makes me think of gold medals.
He's won a lot of them.
He has.
Also in 425 and 420. So a relatively substantial career in that top job.
Sure.
And then we've got the grandfather, Spurius Furius Magellanus Fusus.
Ooh, yeah, that's quite a name.
And if it's this guy, he was the consul in 464 mm-hmm. and the Suffolk in 453.
Mm-hmm.
So we've got this lovely family lineage that relates to the Furii and particularly our favourite Spurius Furius,
mm-hmm.
who has come up in previous episodes, obviously. And then we have this guy, Camillus, right. who is related into this group.
Yeah.
Not the first son. He's praenomen Marcus. His father's name is Lucius. So he's presumably a second or third or fourth child, not the first one. Because you always called the first one after yourself in that really weird Roman way.
Mm.
So we've got that. And then we have Plutarch's The Life of Camillus.
Right.
Which is thematic in its nature. So I get very little about 403 specifically, I would say.
Such a big year.
It's a big year, clearly, but I mean, Camillus.
Mostly because of a big speech. Mostly it is a speech.
But let us give you a bit of a taste of things to come mm-hmm. with Camillus through Plutarch. So he seems to be an incredible figure and he wins many and great successes.
I expect nothing less from a Furia.
5 times he will be chosen dictator.
Wow.
4 times he will celebrate a triumph.
That's pretty good odds.
And he will also become known as the second founder of Rome.
Wait a second. Haven't we already had a guy?
Don't be like that. Okay. Are you arguing with Plutarch right now? I won't have it.
Fair enough. Apologies, Plutarch.
So these are the sorts of things to keep in mind. We've got this sort of foreshadowing of...
Foreshadowing.
Of this great Camillus figure. And it's not at all clear about 403, except that he's listed as the censor in some materials.
Ah, yes. And this is where a tax comes in, does it not?
Well, this is where we get some odd things.
So
this idea of like, what is this censorship? And what is going on with that?
Profound questions all.
Yeah. And apparently the ideas that are connected to his censorship are forcing unmarried people to get married.
Or tax them.
Well, no, wait for it.
Okay.
Yeah, no, don't jump ahead like that.
Okay, sorry.
So the unmarried need to get their marriage on.
Uh-huh.
And apparently this is because there's been so many wars and Rome has lost so many good men.
Well, yeah.
That there is a lot of widows and widowers around.
You might say, Dr. G, that all we need is a few good men.
Indeed. Yeah. And Camillus is going to make sure it happens because there needs to be more children, obviously.
Yep.
Rome cannot succeed if it does not reproduce. It needs its own men. Needs little baby
that
Romans.
That is the battlefield of a woman, is it not?
You know, yes.
To give birth in a time with no medicine.
Yeah. And you can imagine, you know, the women are sitting around being like, well, I lost Marcus last year. And then this year, it doesn't look like Lucius is going to make it through either.
God damn those sandals. They just offer no protection against the cold.
He came back and he didn't have any toes.
What am I going to do with this sweater? It's not going to fit my next husband.
I don't know, Cecilia. I just don't know if I can keep getting married like this.
Quite frankly, I'm so sick of these goddamn letters.
So, you know, it's tough out there for Roman women in general. And, you know, this now new requirement, apparently, because you got to get married.
Right.
So that's it. And then the other thing that seems to be associated with the censorship, which seems particularly cruel, is the taxation on orphans.
I was waiting for that so much. Of course.
Guess what, orphans?
Yeah.
You have not suffered enough in this life, having lost your parents. In fact, there needs to be a specific orphan tax, because if you don't pay your way, no one will.
I'm presuming this is to fund the pay and also the equestrian stipend. But is this because there are so many orphans now?
It seems to be the case that the one to do with the unmarried people is like, you've got to reproduce. And the one with the orphans is you were brought into this world. You were given life. You must continue on and you must serve the
state.
Gotta
pay your way. Yeah.
And just because your relatives aren't around to do the good job of paying the tax that the state needs doesn't mean you get away with it.
Toddlers, this is not a state where you get a free ride.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
You can pay in grain. That's fine. Yeah. But you must pay.
Wow, that is harsh. I saw that and I was like, that must be wrong. But I knew that you were going to be looking into it. So I was like, I'm going to ignore it because it just seems weird and cruel.
It does seem weird and I don't fully understand it. And I feel like maybe our source material hasn't quite wrapped its head around why that would be useful or good or necessary. Certainly with the unmarried Roman population, they're kind of like, you're alive and you have a duty to create life. That's kind of why you're alive. So it's a very sort of like evolutionary determinist perspective, being like, well, you're here, you better get on with it because that's what you're here to do.
You're here. You're not queer. Get used to it.
Yeah. You must and you shall. Yeah. And we will find a way to make you married.
Yeah.
And then the orphan stuff, I don't know. That's just a bit baffling.
Is that a way of forcing people to adopt the orphans?
I don't know. I see the tax seems to fall upon the orphan themselves. I don't know.
That's what I'm. Yeah, I mean, that's the thing. I don't understand why.
Children wandering up to adults, being like, "Please adopt me. I
please
can't
don't make me pay the tax.
I can't afford the tax." And what happens to an orphan if you can't afford to pay the tax?
I know, it's so strange.
It's horrible.
Isn't it? So Camillus covering himself with real glory with that policy.
Yeah. So I can't wait to see what he does next.
Look, I mean, the idea that this might be slightly anachronistic somehow or something like that, it kind of makes sense because obviously some of the details that have been brought up in my account are definitely questioned as maybe being anachronistic. Like the idea that there was that specific punishment for Roman men who were cowardly in battle, you know, the idea that they got beaten with a cudgel as like some sort of penalty or something. We're not really sure. Like it is true. The Romans did take military discipline seriously, particularly later on, which is where we have records of it, you know, coming through sources like, I believe, Cicero. I believe there are references in like Tacitus, Valerius Paterculus, Polybius, and that sort of thing, to this sort of idea that the commander might somehow indicate this person is to be set upon and beaten.
Yeah.
And that sort of thing. But we don't know how far it goes back. And certainly I think the question is, does it go back this far?
Mm.
And as often is the case, the answer is generally no.
We don't know.
We don't know, but probably not. Just because, as we've talked about numerous times with the military pay aspect, we're just not really sure how formal any of this stuff is. So the idea that you would have, I mean, you don't have a formal standing army. I mean, sure, this is meant to be the rumblings of that starting, but you don't have it. This is just a special occasion kind of thing. Surprise. So the idea that you would have formal punishments for this kind of thing is a bit iffy. I mean, it's not out of the question, obviously, because Rome is at war a lot. So maybe there are penalties, but the idea that this was like some sort of official accepted punishment, that's what people are questioning.
Yeah, fair enough.
Yeah. And certainly, definitely, this idea of equestrians receiving some sort of reimbursement or pay and that sort of thing, which, again, does happen later.
Mm-mm.
There are some issues that we will talk about. I mean, it actually gets, I think, quite technical, the whole idea of the cavalry. This doesn't seem likely for this time period, as we've talked about, and this whole military pay thing. And certainly, these taxes, I think, are meant to be feeding into this. But so none of it kind of adds up.
Yeah, we've got more questions than answers. Another classic Partial Historians episode.
Absolutely, yeah. All we can say is unlikely. I mean, it certainly all of these things will be introduced for sure. There definitely will be, because obviously the equestrians are essentially becoming like the cavalry, right?
And I think there is that thing where it's like stuff has to be mentioned for the first time at some point.
Sure, yeah.
That doesn't necessarily mean it's the first time that it becomes regularized.
Yeah, and the cavalry, when they were getting paid, did get paid more because they do have more expenses, I guess, and they are also looked at as being pretty special. But yeah, the idea that Rome has a specific cavalry and a specific infantry and they're each trying to outdo each other to please the Senate.
I vote no.
Yeah, it all seems a little early.
A little premature,
it
perhaps.
It does seem a little bit early, but yes. At least they're trying to figure out where the money's coming from.
Orphans.
Yeah, exactly.
We're going to fund the whole thing on orphans.
Completely logical to pay for rich people's horses, putting a tax on orphans. Just when you thought Rome couldn't get any more conservative.
Weird.
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah. Okay, but I think that is all I have for you, Dr. G.
Okay, in which case, I think it's time for the partial pick.
Oh, I'm looking forward to this. All right, Dr. G, tell us what the partial pick is all about.
Well, there are 50 Roman eagles up for grabs across 5 categories.
Bling, bling.
And so we will see how the Romans score against those categories. The first category being military clout.
Okay, I feel like there's some good and some bad. They are besieging, but then their stuff gets burnt down.
It was all going great when they got to the wall.
Then they get more reinforcements and they seem to be more numerous and better than ever before and morale is high. So I don't know how you want to take that.
On the balance, 5.
Okay. Although I will just point out that you gave them a 6 for actually conquering something last week. I feel like maybe a 4, you know, they're
you're
there.
Asking a consistency from me that I don't possess. I vote solely on my feelings.
Oh, I think that's clear. All right. Okay. Well, let's maybe say a 4, shall we? Because it's, you know, it's consistent.
I can go lower.
No. They're sieging and they haven't been technically defeated. They've just lost some siege equipment and seemingly some people, you know.
And they lost some people burnt to death.
Well, yeah, but that was because they were trying to save the siege equipment. It wasn't in warfare per se.
I mean, you're telling me that saving the siege equipment during an act of war is not somehow part of warfare?
Well, it's not like actual battle-y kind of stuff, you know.
Oh.
We are going to disagree on so much in the future. It's a 4. We're moving on.
The second category is diplomacy.
Well, no. No, definitely no diplomacy anywhere. I mean, okay. If we say internally, I guess the fact that Appius...
I don't think we've agreed that diplomacy is not an internal measure.
Good, I was going to say, I guess if you were saying internal, there's like a bit of speechifying going on, but I don't feel like it's particularly diplomatic because it's Appius Claudius who's speaking.
No diplomacy. They don't talk to Vey. They don't try to talk down the new anonymous king.
No.
Nothing like that. They don't send more ambassadors. It's a no for diplomacy. I don't know what the other 6 or 7 or 8 or 9 whatever military tribunes are doing,
they're
but they're not talking to anybody.
Tribunes scatter.
Hide. They're all behind a different bush. Third category is expansion.
No.
That's a zero.
Yeah, they're trying very hard, but
they would love to have they.
They would love to have
they. Not happening.
No.
The fourth category is Virtus.
Okay. I really hate to say this, Dr. G, but I feel that by Roman standards, maybe we're seeing a little bit of that from Appius Claudius.
You think so? I mean, he's doing some pretty big speechifying.
And but I don't it's not military, though.
We haven't really seen that for a while. But it's not like he's demonstrating classic Roman manliness.
I suppose
either.
That's true. I guess he's just displaying classic Roman douchebaggery. I was mistaken.
Yeah, well, you know, the classic patrician sort of focus on whatever.
His rhetoric is impressive, but yeah, I don't know. I agree with you. It's not perhaps that impassioned.
And it's not like he sort of calls forth the idea of Roman masculinity being on the line here either.
Although he does talk about, you know, the masculinity of the soldiers.
Ouch.
Yeah, you know, like being put into question how they feel. If they feel like you're calling them a pussy, they're not going to like it.
Well, that's true.
Yeah.
But is it manly to call another Roman unmanly?
Well, no, he's not saying they are. He's suggesting that they are indeed, but that the tribunes are implying that they are somehow not man enough to take Vae by saying that they can't hack it in the winter, that they're too prissy to hang out in some proper winter quarters.
I think where we might see Virtus, aside from potential for Appius Claudius, because I feel like that's kind of...
It is a bit wishy-washy.
It's the equestrians coming along and volunteering with their own
horses. Yes.
And then the plebeians coming along not to be outdone by that.
Yes.
And volunteering into a situation where clearly there's been a lot of tension about having people out there.
Of course, I should have known. What else would make the senators shed a tear but Virtus?
Virtus coming from below.
Oh, that sounds raunchy.
Is that your Virtus, or are you just happy to see me?
Oh, I am both. Because if I'm a Roman, I get turned on by that kind of thing. All right. Okay,
so
cool.
I think that's definitely
like a 5?
Yeah.
Okay.
For sure. All and right. Maybe potentially higher, because
do have 2. Yeah.
This is the moment that seems to bring a very specific class of equestrians out that we've never really encountered before.
That's right. The equestrians who are technically part of that order but have their own horses, but the state don't pay for them yet, but they will pay for them after this. That club.
That club, that yeah. Club. Very specific club.
It's very exclusive.
Maybe a 6.
Okay.
All right. And our final category is the citizen score.
Oh, I am so torn on this.
It's a tough time.
Yeah. They are so clearly being manipulated again. And they seem to be standing up for themselves at first. And we do have some good tribune action happening here. Like, the tribunes make some solid points. Mostly, I told you so. But the fact that they are nameless, we don't even know how many there are, they're not given a direct speech.
And also their points become completely ineffectual.
Yeah, exactly. As soon as things start to turn at Vae, the people are just too concerned about what's happening. Oh my God.
So it's not great because, yes, there is the potential for pay. And it has been suggested that that's about to continue for the overwintering. But on the other hand, this siege is not going well so far. And a whole bunch of them seem to have died trying to save the siege equipment in an unruly fire.
And the rest of them have gone off to serve, which, okay, yes, they're getting paid, but they could be stuck there for a while. We don't know how long they're going to be there.
Also, the orphan tax, not great.
That's true. So bleak. It is so bleak. Oh my God.
Being told that you just have to remarry all the time. Just keep going, guys. I mean, by a modern standard, that's a bit harsh. By Roman standards, that's probably people are like, they're like, oh, well, I kind of expected that. But
it's really just legislating what people expected of you anyway.
Yes.
Yeah.
Annoying, but we go.
True, true. Oh, wow. Okay, so I feel like it's maybe a 1 because the tribunes tried.
Oh, yeah.
And that's
all that happened.
Yeah, well, look, let's face it. The plebeians, bless their little cotton socks, which hopefully they're wearing in their winter quarters under their sandals. They seem very happy to be part of this movement to dedicate themselves in this way. You know, they seem to have been completely won over by everything that's happening, the atmosphere, the vibe, if you will. So I feel like they're kind of happy, even though it's so clear that they shouldn't be.
As long as they're happy. We cannot judge them for their own happiness.
Exactly, yeah. So, look, I feel but like I it has to think, be a one.
Yeah, I don't think their condition is great. So one it is. All right.
That means, Dr. G, that we have a grand total of 11, which I was expecting more. Honestly, just goes to show, rhetoric, it blindsides you. I thought it was going to be much higher. But turns out when all you have is a wanker going on and on and on about conservative values, don't get high scores.
Oh, yeah. Look, I'm like, can it be a high score when there's an Appius Claudius in the mix?
No. But you know what I am pleased about? The fact that I am switching douchebag for wanker occasionally now. That's good. That's new. That's going to be a new feature.
Yeah. Look, I mean, it's been a decade. It's time to introduce.
Absolutely. New century is looming.
Oh, my God.
Yeah. Well, thank you very much for tolerating Appius Claudius's speech.
It was good a real to have a pleasure.
Again. Yeah. Thank you for listening to this special episode of The Partial Historians. You can find our sources, sound credits, and an automated transcript in our show notes at www.partialhistorians.com. Our music is by Bettina Joy de Guzman. You too can support our show and help us to produce more engaging content about the ancient world by becoming a Patreon. In return, you receive exclusive early access to our special episodes. Today, we would like to say salve to Stephanie, Teresa, Carl, Roman, and Dylan, some of our recent Patreon members. Thank you very much for your support. It is thanks to all of our supporters that we've been able to overhaul our audio equipment and have debuted the new sound in this very episode. However, if the Emperor has raised your taxes, Ancient Rome, then please just tell someone about the show, our book, or give us a 5-star review for either. Until next time, we are yours in ancient Rome.